Well, I want to welcome Peter Orszag back to the Tax Policy Center. Although it was obviously a huge gain for the country when he became director of the Congressional Budget Office, it was both a professional and a personal loss for us in the Tax Policy Center, where he was a co-director and one of the real prime moving forces behind TPC when we were getting going in our early years. Peter also was a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution. He was the director of the Hamilton Project and the Retirement Security Project. And my guess is people working on those projects would have similar feelings of loss. He took over the Congressional Budget Office as director in January of 2007. And one of the important things that he did was put a real emphasis on health care. He pointed out that health care was going to be an enormous part of the federal budget, and it probably ought to be an important part of what CBO was doing. I mean, obviously, CBO had worked on health care for a long time, but the focus on health care costs and this huge budgetary challenge facing the country going forward, I think, is really important. Peter was also working on the National Economic Council in the Clinton administration in the late 1990s, and I actually heard about Peter before I worked with him. I'd worked with amazing people at the White House, Jason Furman, who's at Brookings, Jeff Liebman, who spoke in the previous panel, who were both incredible to work with. And people kept on talking about Peter as a legendary figure who had been there before. And I thought, yeah, sure. But actually, Peter really is a force of nature. He's an amazing economist. And he also has an incredible knack for explaining complicated things in ways real people can understand. So it's a huge pleasure to welcome Peter back to the Tax Policy Center in Brookings.
Thank you very much.
Thanks, Len. I am thrilled to be back here. I'm going to talk today about about two things. The first is what I see as the very substantial potential inefficiencies in healthcare. And second, changes to the tax code, in particular the administration's tax proposal and how we at CBO analyze it. And let me just preview a little bit of that by saying that I think it's possible that if you take credible estimates from, for example, the Dartmouth-Wenberg folks, suggesting that perhaps as much as 5% of GDP is devoted to health care that does not promote health outcomes or does not raise health outcomes, I can't think of a single other example in which there are credible academics suggesting a 5% potential efficiency gain for the economy, and I will use efficiency loosely, in other sectors. Most of the things that we tend to think of as very important, whether it's trade or marginal tax rates or what have you, generate efficiency effects that are surprisingly small when you actually get down to the nitty-gritty of it. And given that, it's striking that there is this potential, very substantial inefficiency embedded in the healthcare system. And secondly, that I think the lack of clarity about especially employer-sponsored insurance and the foregone wages that workers give up in order to obtain that employer-sponsored insurance is one of the many forces that facilitates that inefficiency in the health system, because it means that workers do not demand as much efficiency from their health plans as would otherwise be the case if they had any idea how much they were actually paying for it. So let me try to walk you through those two things. First, the reason that we've been putting so much more emphasis or putting a lot of emphasis on healthcare at CBO is this graph, which I think even my 6 and 8-year-old can figure out that the light blue area is where the growth is for the future budget. Put simply, the rate at which healthcare costs grow is the single most important factor affecting the nation's fiscal future. And most of the other things that we debate, whether it's the 2001 and 2003 tax legislation or Social Security or what have you, are substantially smaller. And let me actually be a little bit, I don't want to say provocative, but note that I do read the Tax Policy Center's blog. And comment a little bit about a recent posting on that blog about this basic point, because there's been a suggestion that there's a Donnybrook or a big fight going on about the degree to which demographics versus healthcare costs are the key to our fiscal future. I think it's actually pretty simple. You can see it basically from this graph. Demographics are affecting both Social Security and Medicare and Medicaid. If you look out over time, I think it's therefore pretty obvious that demographics are not by themselves the key variable causing the upward trend in overall government spending, as you can see from the fact that the dark blue area does not rise nearly as much as the light blue area. It is also the case that if you look out over the next 10, 15, 20, 30 years, that the demographic component is a larger relative share of the increase, as you can see from the fact that the dark blue area and the increase therein is a larger share of the total as you go out 10, 15, 20 years, and as you go out further than that, it's a smaller share. And in any case, it is not the dominant force. So I think there's sort of a false debate going on about the relative magnitudes. I think it's actually pretty clear, and it depends on the time period that you're examining. And I also want to immediately say that to correctly note that problem A is bigger than problem B, that is, the rate at which healthcare costs per beneficiary is rising is the key to our fiscal future, is not to deny that demographics also affect our fiscal future, and to say that problem A is bigger than problem B is not to say that problem B shouldn't be addressed. So I think there's a lot of underbrush that should just be cleared away. We should be very clear that unless we can slow that excess cost growth rate, that is the rate at which costs are growing relative to income per capita, we face a very dire long-term fiscal problem, and that is why we at CBO are putting so much additional resources into this area. Furthermore, embedded in that central long-term fiscal challenge, I believe, is a very significant potential opportunity to reduce costs without harming health outcomes. And I think there's a wide variety of evidence suggesting that possibility. In my mind, the most compelling is the work that the Dartmouth Group has done on the very substantial variation in cost per beneficiary, which is illustrated in this map with the dark red areas having higher cost per beneficiary than the lighter areas, that cannot be explained on the basis of the underlying health status of the populations in those areas, nor the relative costs of building hospitals or undertaking the provision of medical care in those areas. I would note we just came out with a study on this topic last week that the regional variation in Medicare has declined significantly over the past two or three decades, that the variation in total healthcare spending has not, and whereas two or three decades ago there was significantly more variation in Medicare spending than in the rest of the health system, that is no longer the case. Regional variation in the United States is significantly higher than in Canada or the UK, perhaps not surprisingly, but regional variation in Medicare is about the same as it is in the Veterans Administration, and perhaps that is surprising. In any case, these very substantial variations in cost per beneficiary are not correlated with better health outcomes in the higher spending regions, as that lack of an upward slope in this scatter plot suggests. And if anything, actually, the simple correlation goes the wrong way. Furthermore, the variation seems to be occurring most significantly in those areas where we have the least idea what should happen. So administering an aspirin upon admission to a hospital for someone suffering a heart attack, very clear what should happen. There's very little variation in that across parts of the United States. Imaging and diagnostic tests, where there's a lot more ambiguity about what should occur, there's a lot more variation. Social norms among physicians and medical practitioners vary significantly across different parts of the United States with regard to such interventions. In the darker red areas of the country, there's more of that stuff done. It's not backed by specific scientific evidence that it works better than anything else. It therefore drives up costs without improving health outcomes on average. Some people say, well, okay, that map's really interesting, but we have our top medical centers in those dark red areas, and that's what's driving the variation. So let's look at our top medical centers. Here are three: UCA Medical, Mass General, Mayo Clinic. Medicare beneficiaries last 6 months of life, so they're all pretty sick on average. If you look at quality indicators, which are admittedly imperfect, if anything, the Mayo Clinic does best. If you look at cost per beneficiary, at UCA Medical it's $50,000, at the Mayo Clinic it's $26,000. It leads Elliot Fisher to say, how can the best medical care in the world cost twice as much as the best medical care in the world? And I think that's both a glib question and a deep question at the same time. We are paying for this, and we have no idea what we're getting in exchange for it. And to now tie these things together, I believe one of the reasons, there are many reasons, but one of the reasons that we have no idea what we're paying for and what we're getting in exchange for it is most of us have no idea how much we're actually giving up in take-home pay in order to obtain the health insurance that we have. And I read the paper that Jeff Lehman and Richard Zeckhauser wrote, and I know that they had a part of this discussion in there. And in the version of the paper I got, Jeff Lehman noted that he had tried to obtain the information on the cost to Harvard University of providing his health insurance. I understand that there's some ambiguity about the exact details of what Harvard does or doesn't provide, but the fact that there's an ongoing debate among at least three professors in the room about what Harvard does or doesn't provide, I think makes my point. If PhDs in economics are having difficulty figuring out exactly how much their employer contributes for their health insurance, it is not surprising that most workers don't have any idea. And one of the reasons that occurs is that the health insurance is tax preferred in the form of an exclusion that is not salient to workers and that they therefore don't process. And that, again, I think facilitates the lack of demand for more efficiency in healthcare that we would see if those costs, if you were more transparent. So with that, let me pivot to the tax treatment of health insurance, and in particular, the work that CBO is doing on the topic. We have a model that is a SIP-based microsimulation model in which there are lots of people and families floating around, and we also have synthetic firms that offer insurance, drop insurance, hire workers, et cetera, and a variety of behavioral responses built into changes in the tax system, changes in public coverage, changes in mandates and other requirements that we then use to examine the impact on coverage and other dimensions of the health system. We have a technical paper for anyone who's interested in the details of the model that's posted on our website, and I'd be happy to answer more questions about it after I just run through applying that model to tax proposals. As many of you know, and I actually should pause also, one of the other great things that is occurring, tax proposals, as most people in this room know, get scored officially by the Joint Committee on Taxation. And CBO and JCT are working very closely together, both in terms of their providing technical advice to us on this model and us working collaboratively with them. So let me just pause and acknowledge that a lot of what I'm about to say reflects joint work with the Joint Committee on Taxation. And one of the things that I think is very important institutionally is the growing ties that I know Ed Kleinbart and I are trying to build between JCT and CBO, especially in health, because so many of the proposals are tax-based or related to the tax code, but have spending and other ramifications, and the two agencies must work together to give the best analysis possible. So as you all know, there are a variety of tax proposals floating around. Let me focus specifically on the administration's 2007 tax proposal, which would repeal the existing tax exclusion for employer-sponsored insurance and therefore treat those contributions as taxable income for income and payroll tax purposes. It would eliminate most other health income tax preferences and then create a new standard deduction for coverage that meets certain minimum requirements, a flat deduction of $7,500 for individuals or $15,000 for the family. The 2008 proposal, which we will come out with an initial analysis next Monday, is very slightly different. We'll have a fuller analysis of that proposal in mid-March when we come out with a full analysis of the president's budget. But I want to just emphasize the results today correspond to the 2007 proposal, and the 2008 proposal is slightly different. All right, so what are the key effects of this proposal? The new deduction, or the combination of the new deduction and the removal of the employer-sponsored insurance exclusion, would result in a net flow from the pool of uninsured and employer-sponsored insurance into the non-group market. The net effect of which is, again, a reduction in employer-sponsored insurance, but not an elimination or complete collapse of that system. And I want to come back to that. And a reduction, an overall reduction in the number of uninsured people. And I'll get to that too. In addition, because the deduction is fixed and doesn't increase with the generosity of the plan or of the benefit, There is not an incentive to have the gold-plated plans, and the net result is a reduction in the actuarial value of employer-sponsored insurance, which is one of the objectives of the proposal. So some of the key effects that we estimate that in 2010, the net impact of the proposal would be a reduction in the number of uninsured people of 7 million. And that reflects basically two forces. One is a reduction in the number of people receiving employer-sponsored insurance of 7 million, and a net increase in the non-group market of 14 million, so that the net impact is a reduction in the number of uninsured of 7 million. By 2016, the impact is smaller, and this is one of the key dynamics of the proposal. That deduction is indexed only to inflation, whereas ongoing healthcare cost growth and the exclusion that is then being eliminated obviously goes up faster than inflation. And so over time, the net impact changes because the deduction doesn't keep pace with the overall rate of healthcare cost growth. And you can see that on this chart. The black line is that standard deduction. This is for a family. And the other lines are our estimates of what the premiums would be for employer-sponsored insurance at different parts of the distribution. Let's focus on the average, that yellow line. You can see that the deduction starts off larger than the premium, which creates a strong incentive for coverage. But over time, the deduction rises much less rapidly. And that both creates a revenue gain because the exclusion is now reflecting new revenue coming in. The deduction is a new tax expenditure. So the net impact in terms of revenue becomes more and more positive over time. But in terms of coverage, things go the other way because that's exactly the flip side of the fact that the government is basically gaining more revenue over time. People are relatively losing a tax benefit over time on average. That's all average, though. And of course, the effects will also vary very substantially by type of individual. For an individual, if you look at the pure financials of this, and I want to come back to that because I think we put far too much emphasis on the pure financials, and I want to come back again to the behavioral stuff. But if you look, for example, at younger workers who are higher income and in better health, you can see that their premiums, that's on the red part, look lower relative to the value of their new tax deduction, that's the yellow part, than for older workers who are poorer and in worse health. And that's both because the poorer workers will get less benefit from a deduction as opposed to, say, a refundable credit or some other alternative form of tax subsidy, and because their premiums for workers who are less healthy and older in the non-group market can be higher than for those who are younger and healthier. And so you tend to get a shift where the new system is most advantageous to younger, healthier, higher income workers, especially among the uninsured, but the pool of uninsured is tilted towards the bottom end of the income distribution, so you're basically picking up the top of a distribution that's shifted towards the bottom of the overall distribution, and let me try to illustrate that. If you look at the bottom rows of these two sets of numbers, the percent of uninsured who move into the non-group market as a result of the policy, you can see that in general, as you move up the income distribution, that share is increasing. And as you move up the health distribution, that share is increasing. And that just illustrates the point that I just made. But if you also look at the numbers, so take the 7 million who move from uninsured to non-group, and look at where that's distributed, the bulk of the people are certainly in the bottom 60% of the income distribution, and there's a significant concentration in the bottom 40% of the income distribution, which illustrates the point that you're, again, picking out basically perhaps the top part of a distribution that is shifted towards the lower part of the income distribution, and therefore overall, depending on exactly how you do the distributional analysis, things can look either progressive or regressive depending on what kind of analysis you're doing, but it looks better than just looking at the bottom row would suggest. Okay, now what about employer-sponsored insurance? There's a lot of concern that this would blow up the employer-sponsored market. There is a reduction that occurs in the employer-sponsored market of roughly 7 million. I note there are some people who actually, especially towards the beginning, take up employer-sponsored insurance because the new deduction is worth so much to them relative to the premium for employer-sponsored insurance that there are at least a few of those people. Nonetheless, there is a net reduction in employer-sponsored coverage, which in some sense is one of the intentions of the policy to shift away from that form and towards the individual market. But there's not a collapse. The vast bulk of people who are of working age will still be receiving their coverage through employer-sponsored insurance. And I think that reflects a variety of forces. First, it reflects the fact that employers are still relatively efficient from an administrative perspective of pooling workers. It reflects the elasticities that are built into our model, which reflect a significant amount of inertia in real-life behavior among people. And I think this comes back to the point that Richard and Jeff were trying to make about how people actually make decisions and the stickiness of many defaults. And there are the larger changes for small firms than large firms that partly reflects the administrative cost point. But I would also note that among those who retain their employer-sponsored insurance, there is effectively, because of this change in financial incentives, and perhaps also an effect that we don't have fully built in, perhaps also more importantly even, because of the transparency that would come with seeing how much your employer is contributing for your health insurance, a desire and demand which is then manifested in a lower actuarial value of the plans that are actually offered. So we estimate roughly a 12% reduction in the actuarial value of employer-sponsored insurance as a result of this proposal. And that is, again, one of the purposes of the proposal. I want to just stop again, though, and say I think the direct financial impact, which is sort of what's reflected in our estimates, may ultimately turn out to be a less important thing than the impact of transparency and cost consciousness that occurs with seeing what is actually being paid for and realizing how much your take-home pay is being affected by those contributions. So there's another channel that ultimately may turn out to be the most important, and that you could also, by the way, get from not even changing the tax treatment, but rather by just providing more information and clarity about what's happening. So that I'm going to wrap up just with a few longer-term issues. One is there are some questions about the dynamics of how the change in financial incentives will affect both the actuarial value of firm employer-sponsored insurance and the overall healthcare system. What would happen in the non-group market with a significant inflow of people, and would there be changes to try to improve the structure and regulatory oversight and other aspects of that market? Would the movement of less healthy people out of employer-sponsored insurance pressure policymakers to adopt other approaches to either shoring up the employer-sponsored insurance or shoring up public coverage? And then, as I've said before, what is the sort of pure impact of transparency on behavior? And I suspect, without any firm knowledge of this, that that may ultimately turn out to be among the most important effects. So let me just close by saying this is one example of how we use the new model that we have developed. We are going to be doing a lot more work on health care over the coming months and years. We've significantly bolstered our staff in the area. And I just want to mention one thing that we are doing this year that will be out towards the end of this year or early next year, which we're calling Critical Topics in Health Reform. There are lots of proposals floating around, and I would just, make sure that those people who are very active in the policy debate are listening. There are lots of proposals that are floating around on care coordination, disease management, health information technology, other topics that have numbers associated with them from various different places that are not from the Congressional Budget Office. But ultimately, it will be our responsibility to evaluate their impact on cost and coverage and what have you. And my intention is to put this volume out so that people are then not surprised when they're putting together packages what our thinking is on various topics. So we're going to march through all of the main topics that are under discussion, provide ranges for potential budget and other impacts, and say if you do it this way, it's likely to kind of be towards the end of this end of the range. You do it that way towards the other end of the range. And that way, you may not like the answer, but at least you won't be surprised. So with that, I will close it. Thank you, and I have time for questions. Thank you. If there are any. Len. Oh, Larry.
instead of replacing the exclusion with a standard deduction, have you done replacing it with a progressive refundable tax credit, or is that something you will be doing?
It's something we can do. Is David Auerbach in the room? Have we actually done that?
Informally.
Yeah, informally. So it is eminently doable.
And then also, with or without an individual mandate system, part of the simulation is also used.
Yes, we can do that.
How would the limit on the tax exclusion relate to,
Right. That is one of the questions that has arisen with regard to the plan. We're going to have more to say on that, I guess, on Monday or when we come out with the full analysis. I would just say this reflects our best guess of all of the interactions that are embodied, and I can't give you a finer disaggregation. Henry.
What would be the impact if there were a more rapid rate of dropping of sponsorship by employers?
If there were a more rapid rate of sponsorship by employers, I would anticipate that we would see some increase in the flow into the non-group market, but that the net impact would be a larger increase, a smaller reduction in the number of uninsured, or perhaps even a flipping thereupon. That is to say, if instead of 7 million people switching from employer-sponsored insurance, there was more employer dropping and it was 20 or 30 million, some of those people would wind up in the non-group market, but a lot of them wouldn't, and it may be large enough to flip the sign.
Have you done any sensitivity analysis, or are you planning on that?
We have done sensitivity analysis on a lot of this stuff, because obviously all of this is dependent on elasticities that are built into the model, and some of them are actually, even in our 2008 analysis, will be a little bit different than in the 2007 analysis, but we are well aware that the specific results depend sensitively on those underlying elasticities. I think the question, the fundamental question you're asking is, do you expect, and some people have suggested this, a collapse, so it's far larger than the kind of impact that we see, a collapse in employer-sponsored insurance as a result of this. And again, when you look at the potential efficiencies of pooling of the payroll system that is associated with the employer-sponsored system, I mentioned administrative costs, it is our view, and this is obviously, we haven't done this, so we don't know for sure, but it is our view that the employer-sponsored system would remain the mainstay of the system. I want to come back, because I think this is an important point. There are a lot of proposals floating around. For example, the Wyden-Bennett, or Bennett-Wyden, depending on who's speaking, proposal that would represent fundamental change to the healthcare system and introduce public pooling, effectively, at the state level that would replace, to some large degree, if not exclusively, employer-sponsored system. And I think some of the questions that were coming up this morning about complexity and about default choices and about what happens there are important. I would also note that most of those involve very significant reliance on the tax system as both an enforcement mechanism and as a delivery of subsidies. And the paper that Janet Holtzblatt wrote about some of the administrative complexities that are involved in that are also important in analyzing those kinds of proposals, but I suspect that we will see a growing number of proposals that involve very significant alternatives to the employer-sponsored system. And I suppose, to the extent you're worried that a proposal like this would cause a collapse of the employer-sponsored system, it would be good if a lot of the plumbing and analytical work that's necessary to think about alternative pooling mechanisms is advancing, and I would just say I believe it is.
I want to, Lynn's paper this morning reminded us of the formula, sort of the net price of health insurance. read all these things about the alternative minimum tax pushing more people into our tax brackets, so on. If the Congress doesn't do anything about alternative minimum tax, wouldn't this basically increase the subsidy for group insurance?
Yeah, although the net the impact of the alternative minimum tax on marginal tax rates can be a little bit complicated, as both Len and Bill Gale have noted. It depends exactly where you are in the phase out and other parts of the alternative minimum tax. I don't think you want to just immediately conclude that because you're on the AMT, your marginal tax rate is higher. Your average tax rate may be higher, but your marginal tax rate may not be. Although for many people, ironically, even though the statutory rate on the AMT is lower than the top marginal tax rate, it can raise marginal tax rates for significant numbers of taxpayers. So I guess I wouldn't expect that to be a very very substantial effect. You've noted correctly that obviously the value of the deduction or the value of the exclusion depends on marginal tax rates. And but I don't think the changes in the marginal tax rates that we're talking about are substantial enough to suggest very strong behavioral changes that respond to that. I note, though, and before we take the next question, I just want to again highlight a point about a lot of the externality-related tax preferences that we have. And I include the exclusion for health insurance. I would include the exclusion and various deductions and tax preferences for retirement saving. I would include the mortgage interest deduction. I would include estimates suggest up to $200-$400 billion per year in tax expenditures that are sort of externality related. They are intended to promote socially beneficial activities. And I think there's an important question that needs to be raised about why those tax exclusions, as opposed to things that are intended to measure net income more accurately, like a deduction for business expenses, why those should be linked to marginal tax rates. Because unless you believe that higher marginal tax rate households generate larger social benefits when they do respond, or have larger elasticities, they respond more in response to a tax incentive, it's not clear to me why one would want to create a larger per dollar tax subsidy for higher marginal tax rate households than lower marginal tax rate households. And that represents, since there's, a very substantial amount of money involved in that, I think that represents a very important question that hasn't really received that much attention in the policy world.
I'm Jack Dunley from Berkeley, California. I think my question relates to what you've just been talking about. In a world without health insurance, it's quite arguable that as a matter of income tax theory and policy, there should be a deduction for medical expenses, maybe above the threshold, but maybe just for any medical expenses. Now, a deduction is income variable in the sense that a $100 deduction saves high income bracket taxpayer more than it saves low income bracket taxpayer. But a justification for that point of view is to say, look, if each one spent $100 at the hospital or $1,000 or $10,000, that wasn't income that he or she got to use or consume or save. It was kind of like a disaster loss that the vote was taken away from him. So we're just simply not going to tax him on the amount, we're going to lower his tax bill by the amount we would have increased it if he hadn't had this deductible expenditure. Now, if health insurance costs, insurance premiums are surrogates for actual payments for hospital bills and doctor bills, then arguably from an income tax perspective, there should be a deduction for those amounts paid. Might it be better to leave the income tax working that way and provide whatever subsidy or benefit to the poor or other redistribution by means other than the income tax?
Well, I guess so this does relate to the point that I was just making, and one needs to think about why we are providing those tax preferences and whether they are intended to more accurately measure net income. Under your theory of the case, it's I spend $100 on healthcare, and so I don't have that available to consume or do other things with, and we want to tax non-health income, basically. or we're providing this because we believe healthcare has various social benefits associated with it, and we want to encourage health insurance for that purpose. I think one can, a little bit of this is in the eye of the beholder, and one can draw that line differently depending on different tax preferences. My own perspective, for whatever it's worth, and it's obviously not definitive, is that the things that I mentioned, including this exclusion and including retirement saving and including the various tax preferences for home ownership, strike me as more motivated, or the policymakers who were creating them were sort of more motivated by that kind of thought of the externality or social good than measuring net income. But again, that's not necessarily the case, and I know people, let me put it this way. That's based on a loose impression of current policymaking intention and not a careful reading of legislative history, because I think the legislative history could lead one to a different conclusion. Len.
Thanks. Your analysis, which I think is great, it sort of highlights just how much we don't know, and we can't really infer from the literature. You know, how important is this transparency factor? How important would it be? What happens when you throw 15 million people into the non-group market? One thing you didn't mention is how many small employers offer insurance now because it's the only way the employer himself or herself could get the tax break. When you do your analysis, it's probably really important, and us as well, when we do our analysis, just highlight how much uncertainty there is. The range is really huge, and they could embrace what seems like, you know, statistically maybe not really large differences, but from a policy perspective look really, really big, because under some scenarios you could actually have a reduction in the net number of people with coverage, and others you have an increase. And what we stress is that there are certain kinds of policies that would dominate others. This one, there's a lot of risk, and I think if you showed a table of who's losing coverage on net, it would show that people in worse health status are more likely to be losing coverage, people with lower incomes. And there are other policies, like, for example, if you had a refundable credit, that would dominate in those respects. So, comment.
Yeah, no, and let me just, again, emphasize, I think there is significant uncertainty surrounding the relevant parameters here. That's clear. There's also, just coming back to this earlier point about this variation, just in healthcare in general, healthcare and actually education in general, it strikes me, it is just remarkable how little we actually know about what works and what doesn't. And that, I'll focus on healthcare since this is a conference about healthcare. But it is amazing that the kind of variation that I put up before persists. We spend a lot of time sort of casually examining the United States versus other countries, which is subject to a lot of cross-country noise and difficulty in analyzing. There is such substantial variation within the United States. Those light areas of the country are delivering healthcare at the same or lower cost and the same or better quality as all those comparison countries that people put up. And this is within the same payment system. So one might think that it would be more productive to examine this kind of thing. And I am struck by how little is actually done to get under the hood of this. And that's obviously a different dimension of lack of knowledge. But if in any other area there were serious people who thought that we could actually pick up 5% of GDP effectively for free, that is in terms of no adverse consequences to health, one would think that there would be a lot more energy and activity going into trying to capture it. And I would also, I also just want to use that, and I know there's a question, I just want to use that also to say, coming back to the point I made about the political economy of the nation's long-term fiscal problem, I think we have, I think the thing that's unfortunate, actually, is that we have mischaracterized that the political economy of the long-term fiscal problem as being mostly about one generation sacrificing for another generation, and there's a part of the problem for which that's true. I think the core political economy problem, though, is that in this stuff, cost for someone is income for someone else. And that is the key political economy problem that impedes our progress on the nation's long-term fiscal problem. And it's not whether it's grandma versus the grandkid, it's that problem. And I think until we get past that confusion, which is unfortunately too prevalent in my former habitats, we're not actually going to tackle that light blue area in any constructive way. I'm going to pay for that, aren't I?
Your numbers are two questions. How are you figuring what's going to be taxable for the ESI plan? Question number one. Given the degree of geographic variance and the huge number of differences in the board plan. And second, what are you planning, what part of the proposal is going to be allowed for differences in deduction that are similarly based on the geographic?
Okay, well, the administration's proposal has a flat deduction depending on your whether you're single or married, and that doesn't vary across parts of the country. Like, so that is what it is. In terms of our model, we have state-level detail, including some regulatory components in each state. So we do have variation that occurs, and I gave you the national numbers. That occurs in terms of the variation across firms, as I think I may have mentioned, we have these synthetic firms that are created in the model to try to replicate what we actually see in the real world. And obviously, just coming back to Hank's point, it is a model. It is not reality. It is a model. It's the best that we think we can do, and we think it's among the best that exists. But it is dependent on the parameters that we put into it, and is dependent on the assumptions we make about how the firms form themselves and hire workers and what have you. And I guess I don't really see an alternative to that. But there is a significant amount of variation in the model across firm types and across different parts of the country. Yep. Well, the numbers do change over time, and that's being driven mostly by that gap that I showed you between the deduction and the premium slash the exclusion under current law. I would note that according to estimates from the JCT, this proposal generates a significant revenue gain. And so there, over time, there could be money put back into the system if you wanted to change these numbers. They're just underscoring the point that Hank and Len and others have made about the uncertainty of many of the parameters involved. You are changing two big numbers, an exclusion, and you're creating this new deduction. And the revenue impact is the net of those two. Small differences in what you assume about those two big numbers can have dramatic effects on the net number. And that is reflected in the fact that the administration has a significantly different number, which is much closer to zero, than the Joint Committee on Taxation does for the same proposal. And I think that just underscores the points that have been made about some of the uncertainty that's involved in studying large changes that are changing two big things, and that, you know, the budget world depends on the net number of which.
Can we go back to the map for just a minute?
Sure.
I have a question for
this is the spending per capita. Is a possible explanation is because when people who live in Montana want health care, they go to a place where it's redder, and that's where the spending is credited? Or is this based upon the patient's home address?
It's based upon where they receive the bulk of their care, so it's possible, but I think very unlikely, that net migration is affecting these results significantly. When people look at, try to do this, and I'm gonna give you one counterexample in a second, but when people try to control for basically net migration and other forces, I mean, there is some difference. I mean, there are differences in health status, there are differences in income, there are other differences that affect spending. In general, you can reduce the variation by perhaps a third or so, with a substantial amount of variation that exists. Now, ideally, we want a randomized trial, right? Where I randomly pick up people from Montana and I plop them down in Florida and I plop them down in some other state and see what happens. But I think there are many things in which someone once said, you know, we're never gonna have a randomized trial on whether parachutes work. And I also think that this is unfortunately one of those settings in which we're probably never gonna know. So you struggle the best you can. Now, there is one study that is the subject of some methodological debate that studies people treated just in Florida who are visiting from other areas, so it kind of gets a little bit at the point, and then go to an emergency room. And that study suggests that the people who visit emergency rooms in the darker parts of Florida, darker red parts of Florida, actually have better outcomes than the people who visit from other parts of the country and who wind up in the lighter parts of Florida, which may suggest that this inefficiency or the regional variation and the lack of correlation with outcomes doesn't exist. I would just note that there are questions about that study, and furthermore, one might think that, in fact, we do think, that there may be types of medical care where higher spending does actually pay off in terms of outcomes, and it may well be that emergency room visits are picking up that channel disproportionately relative to other types of health spending. So short answer is, I can't give you a perfect explanation, a perfect answer, and not only that, but with regard to, say, the Mayo Clinic, people raise the same point. They say, oh, it has to be the case, one of the things going on here is UCLA Medical is winding up with all the schmucks who live around LA, and they just show up at UCLA Medical, whereas at the Mayo Clinic, people are flying there specifically to be treated. And I would just say that the people I talk to who have tried to kind of grapple with that suggests it's not the dominant explanation for this difference, but there is some of that that goes on, and so some of the kind of phenomena that you're highlighting occurs. I just don't think it comes anywhere close to explaining the variation that we see. Any other questions? All right, well, thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be back here.
We're going to reconvene in 15 minutes.
No.